I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. The landmark gains of the civil rights movement ushered in an age known as the Minority Rights Revolution. From women to the disabled, ethnic minorities to gays and lesbians, the 1960s and 1970s witnessed a dramatic expansion of rights for previously disadvantaged groups. University of Southern California sociologist Hajar Yazdiha argues that understanding the uses and abuses of the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement is central to both the ongoing story of the minority rights revolution and the backlash against it. Dr. King and the civil rights movement have become a usable past for groups spanning the political spectrum to advance their vision of the country or to roll back changes they reject. To delve more deeply into this subject, I'm very pleased to welcome Hajar Yazdiha to discuss her recent book, The Struggle for the People's King, How Politics Transforms the Memory of the Civil Rights Movement. Haj, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to start with a question about how you got interested in this topic to begin with. You mentioned in your book that you were in graduate school during the Obama administration, and you started to notice some particular uses of the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. Can you tell the story of what you noticed and how it sparked your curiosity?
Yeah, so I had been fascinated by the civil rights movement since I was a kid. I mean, I was a kid of immigrants, and there was just something about this story of people, just everyday regular folks, young people, just rising up and creating such change. And so it was during graduate school that I noticed this kind of reactionary politics coming out of the Obama presidency. It was the rise of groups like the Tea Party. It was this increasing language of reverse racism. And I even start the book off with the story of Glenn Beck, who's, of course, this kind of right-wing figure who's central in the Tea Party. And he's standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. It's the anniversary of the March on Washington. And he's saying that the Tea Party is claiming the mantle of the civil rights movement. And so it's instances like these where, you know, it's white folks that are claiming that Obama is racist against white people. And then it's this one particular case that really gets me. So this is the case of Abigail Fisher. And you might recall, she's this young white woman who was rejected from the University of Texas at Austin. And so they end up taking her case to the Supreme Court to try to repeal affirmative action. And, you know, I'm watching and I'm just rapt, and I can't even wrap my head around the fact that their legal argument rests on the idea that affirmative action is a form of reverse racism, that it's unconstitutional because it uses race consciousness in college admission. And so it's this kind of co-optation of civil rights language that has me start digging deeper. And I realize that, you know, there are all sorts of cases of this happening, and that what's especially jarring is that in so many of these cases, they're using the language of Dr. King. They're using that idea that Dr. King himself would have been opposed to any race-conscious legislation because he would think that we shouldn't be judged, you know, by the color of our skin. We should be judged by the content of our character. And for me, it was that kind of co-optation and using his words in a way that I knew he wouldn't agree with. You know, I'd been studying this guy. So that's really where the project began, is noting this co-optation. I wasn't the first to notice it. Folks have been calling this out for decades. But I did think that there was something there in actually putting these puzzle pieces together and tracing these misuses of memory over time and try to see what that story could tell us.
And I think maybe up front, it's important to make the point, why does this matter? So why does it matter if that past gets co-opted? What's at risk? What could be lost?
Yeah, I think that's the big question. And it's something I think about a lot because, you know, folks are like, all right, well, you know, we never remember history exactly as it happened. There's always this kind of process of erasure and forgetting. And for me, that's quite different than intentionally misusing, intentionally distorting the past and using it for other political purposes. And so in this case, we find that Dr. King's memory has been weaponized against the actual multicultural democracy that he fought for and he was killed for. And so it's really in noting that it's not just about the fact that history gets forgotten or misused. It's about the fact that it has consequences for the way that we understand who we are as a society, where we've been, and particularly where we're going. And so it's really an understanding that connection between the past, present, and future that I think we see, oh, it's actually quite dangerous to engage in this politics of historical revisionism.
And I think you mentioned as well that this weaponization of the past, it relies in part on societal ignorance. And what do you mean by societal ignorance?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm really drawing from this idea from Charles W. Mills. And it's the idea that there is this epistemology of willful ignorance that's created. And it's one that really maintains the status quo. It maintains an idea of white supremacy in society. And it doesn't have to be in your face like it was, you know, during the period of enslavement or even during Reconstruction or Jim Crow. It's really about the idea that it blinds us from the realities of the past, and it makes it easy to just go about our lives as if inequality exists because of individual failings, for example, and not to understand how they're rooted in these systems of inequality that are embedded in our societal structures. And so that's really where I try to draw out ignorance, not in the common way we think about it, which is that all people are just, they haven't been educated, you know, or maybe, you know, in the worst kind of case, we say like, oh, they're just kind of stupid. And it's not ignorance in that way. It's ignorance that's willfully created. It's a part of a culture. And I think the politics of historical revisionism are one of the ways that we see how it takes shape, how it takes hold. I mean, this is really embedded in everything from the books that we read in school, you know, the historical lessons, the way that we celebrate national holidays, and also the movies that we consume, television, all of these media representations. And so it's really this multidimensional culture of ignorance.
But it's essentially to the general public buying into what you describe as this defanged, flattened presentation of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights past.
Yeah. And I mean, and why wouldn't they, right? And this is me included, right? Because growing up, all we had was part of that I Have a Dream speech. You know, that's all we would ever watch. And I loved it, right? But I didn't even know about the first half of the speech, where Dr. King is really taking the country to task. You know, he's really laying out a plan. He's calling them out. He's saying that the marchers have come to the nation's capital to cash their check, right? And I think it's this idea that we remember King as this peace-loving, you know, never ruffled kind of moral authority that led this country out of the dark ages of racism into this post-racial era. And that's really where the project of historical revisionism comes in, because one of the things I show in the book is just how that construction of King takes shape and becomes institutionalized in national memory. And so, again, it's not the fault of individuals that they don't know, because this is really the King that has been fed to us years and years and years over. And so I think it's really about understanding, first of all, how he gets distorted and sanitized and why. But then second, to think about how even that kind of revisionist or, you know, rosy memory then gets co-opted and remade toward these more sinister ends, the ones that actually begin to repeal the work of the civil rights movement.
So you tie in the making of the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. with the national holiday. And you mentioned that this is a holiday that's proposed almost just days after he's assassinated, but it takes 15 years before it's finally enacted in 1983. And it's enacted by an unlikely president, President Reagan, who himself was very critical of the civil rights movement. So how does this holiday come about? Why is it Reagan who's the one that ends up pushing it through?
Yeah, that's right. I know. Well, so that's what's so interesting is, yes, just as you said, it's just a day after his assassination, Congressman John Conyers introduces this legislation for the King holiday. But we also have to remember that when King's assassinated, he is so deeply unpopular. You know, he has been speaking out against the kind of evils of capitalism and imperialism. He has been out in the streets speaking out against the government. And so 75% of the public at that point have this deeply unfavorable view of King. So when he's assassinated, of course, there's, you know, all this mourning. But at the same time, many folks feel that he brought it on himself. They feel that even his quote unquote nonviolent methods instead provoked a lot of violence and that, you know, it's all kind of a farce. So with that said, you know, for Conyers to introduce this legislation, you know, backed by Coretta Scott King, King's widow, who's a civil rights activist herself, it's this sort of setting where folks are like, why would we create a national holiday to remember a guy that most folks really didn't like very much? And so to win that support over the years, King's family, his allies, they're promoting this image of King as somebody that can be remembered for everyone. And so they're remembering his message of tolerance and nonviolence and brotherhood. So Conyers and then Shirley Chisholm eventually, with Coretta Scott King, they're introducing this bill time and again. And so slowly over these years, some support for the bill is building. And President Carter in particular is supportive, but they still need that congressional support. And so, in the chapter that I describe the making of the holiday, I talk about these kind of vicious debates that are taking place in congressional halls over King. And you have, on the one hand, folks that are calling him a communist. They're calling him an adulterer. They're saying, why would we remember somebody who was so deeply immoral? But then by 79, Coretta Scott King organizes this nationwide petition for the holiday. And this is where you get Stevie Wonder, the musician, coming on board. And so many people have heard the Happy Birthday song by Stevie Wonder, but they don't realize it was about Dr. King. And so they're gaining this public support. So by the time Reagan is president, he kind of doesn't have a choice because the congressional votes are there. And of course, he has been avoiding this. He does not like King. He does not like the civil rights movement. So he is not particularly eager to institutionalize a national holiday, especially one that's going to use, national money to pay for this federal holiday. It's actually one of the arguments is like, oh, it's going to cost too much. It's not worth it. But, once he realizes that he's going to have to reckon with this, he also realizes that this could be a political opportunity. And so he and his team really think about how this could be a chance to remember a very selective version of Dr. King, one that strips him of his radical legacy, that uses him as a symbol of the racism that's been defeated by this kind of American exceptionalism, this nation where anybody can pull themselves up from their bootstraps. So King becomes a symbol of individualism, of a free America. And so through Reagan's presidency, he ends up using this image of a distorted Dr. King to justify all sorts of, revisions and kind of repeals of civil rights movement gains that really, brought this individualism to the forefront. Like, this is really a chance to say, you know what? Like, anybody can make it. And so if you're not making it, it's probably your own fault. And I think that's really where you see some of these early co-optations take place.
Yeah, so I think we see this as part of the present, the rollback of civil rights gains. And you're really pointing out, no, you really got to go back to the Reagan era. And this memory of the civil rights past gets reframed and it becomes I don't know whether a smokescreen is the right word for it, but it becomes a way to roll back those gains. So a lot of things are happening that you mentioned, you list out in your book during the Reagan administration.
Yeah. And smokescreen is a good way to describe it. I've thought of it as like a Trojan horse. It's kind of like you take all of your political goals and you sort of shove them into the King statue and then kind of put him as the forefront and say like, oh, Dr. King would support this because of XYZ. And so it's a really convenient way to make Dr. King mean something that not only did he not, but also that he himself would have opposed and quite often actively did in his lifetime. So I think it's understanding that it's not just about how we remember the past. It's about how the past gets used in the service of these political projects. That's really the interest of the book.
So is it fair to say that if you get this watered down memory of King, this flattened version that can be used by the right, it never would have been possible if the King family hadn't gone along, as Coretta Scott King in particular? I mean, is that the price you pay for this to become a national holiday?
That question has kept me up at night because I think about, you try to think about counterfactuals, right? Some people have said like, well, what if King never gave his I Have a Dream speech? Like, would it have been possible to even think of him as like this one figure and take those, one line that gets reused over and over? And in the same sense, it's that question of, had Coretta Scott King put her foot down and said, that is not what my husband stands for, it really stood for, like the radical King, would he ever have gotten to be institutionalized? I don't think so. It's hard to imagine a world where you could make him palatable to the American public or even Congress for that matter. And I think that's one of the trade-offs that we have to think about is when we do memorialize somebody on a national stage like that, is there a way to preserve their complexity? Or is it just by its own very nature going to be folded into the larger political project, the status quo? Is it just going to be a way to make sure to maintain the nation's story of itself? So I think that's actually something we should continue to grapple with. And I think one of the things I think about a lot is that it's not that it was Coretta Scott King's fault per se. I think it's the idea that she knew that certain concessions would have to be made, but she never could have known all of these unintended consequences in the sense that even if you water somebody down, even if you kind of whitewash them a little bit, you know, smooth out some of the kinks, do you have to then co-opt them and use them against the very things they would fight for, right? Like that seems like quite the leap. So I do wonder if there's a space to remember, understanding that remembrance is always partial, but without undermining the kind of core values, the core meanings of that symbol.
Okay. So you mentioned, you use the image of a tree, and trees are often connected to memory, and you use the image of a tree and gnarled branches to try to make sense of what happens with the memory of MLK and the civil rights movement. And you stress that the King holiday, maybe do you see the King holiday as the beginning of this memory tree? That's the trunk of the tree, and then it goes off in different directions. And you've got these two main branches that you stress on the right, maybe colorblind individualism going back to Reagan, on the left, this unfinished business going back to the King family version. What are these two main branches? How do they fork off in other directions? How do they overlap?
Yeah. I struggled with that conceptualization too, because I think memory is such a complicated kind of system. And it always goes, you have to begin it like at a certain point. But even though in the book, I begin the analysis with the King holiday, and I really think about that as the national institutionalization of King, at the same time, I mean, the memorialization of King was already happening even when he was alive. And so I don't want to make it seem like this was the one point when he started kind of being remembered and misused, because that had been happening, far, far before. So I think about the tree in the sense that when you get these competing uses and misuses of memory, it's like this fracture in the base of the kind of trunk of the collective memory. So like you said, on the one hand, we have the folks that remember the unfinished dream. This is the civil rights activists. This is the progressive groups that are using King's memory to make claims for other oppressed groups. And then on the other hand, you have the colorblind individualists like Reagan and other conservative groups that are really thinking about racism as a figment of the past and really want to use King's memory to harden the idea that racism is done. And so now we can use him as a symbol of individualism, of this free market. So what happens is, through the Reagan presidency into the Bush presidency and really into the Clinton presidency, we see these branches grow where by the 90s, folks think racism's over. And now civil rights are actually special rights that only advantaged minorities are taking, and that it is disadvantaging white people. So this is where we start to get some of the branches that really think about white grievance, that think about civil rights as infringements on the rights of conservatives, of white people. And so this unfinished dream is also growing through the Clinton era. At the same time, you have groups like the gay rights movement that are growing. And then, of course, you also get things like Gingrich's Contract with America, which is the conservative backlash. It's trying to dismantle the safety net. It's protecting white Christians. It's really calling for personal responsibility. So these two competing branches are growing and splitting off into kind of sub-branches, you could say. So then during Clinton, you're also getting a sort of white Christian victimhood branch. And this is one that's really claiming the moral legacy of the civil rights movement. It's thinking about King as this moral figure who would be opposed to everything from abortion to homosexuality. But now as we enter the post 9/11 era with G.W. Bush, you start to get more of the multicultural colorblindness branch. And now this one is more complicated because it's not a conservative branch. It's one that gets used by centrists. It gets used even by progressive groups. And it's this idea that the civil rights movement is not just this American accomplishment of unity, but it's also one that thinks about how all sorts of groups can maintain their individual identities and that that is part of the American dream. And so by that point, we're getting more into a white nationalism branch as well. So white victimhood is growing into white nationalism. You're getting claims that King's Christianity would be for family values causes. It would be against reverse racism. And then, of course, this is then going to bring us to the Obama and Tea Party white lash era. And this is really where then you start to get some of the more radical King coming back into play. You get the systemic racism branch where folks are drawing on King's comments, the letter from a Birmingham jail. They're thinking about mass incarceration as the new Jim Crow. And at the same time, you're getting white nationalism turning into white rage. So really accusing progressives of keeping racism alive. And so systemic racism then really draws into this radical King that we remember and the movement for Black Lives. And this is the one that we see a lot today, is reclaiming his fight against those triple evils, you know, racism, imperialism, capitalism. And so through all of this, I think about these as the gnarled branches, because it's not that one replaces the next. It's really that they grow into one another and they're deeply intertwined. So even though it seems like they're doing completely different political projects, they're relational. They are shaped in relationship to one another, and they are constantly in competition with one another.
So if you look at all these different branches, at least on the right side of the tree, that grow out of the colorblind individualism branch, is there a fundamental failing on the part of the media that makes that possible, just in terms of accountability and reality checks?
Yeah. Yeah. I say in the book that media is like hugely complicit. And this isn't just right-wing media like Fox News. This is also the New York Times, Washington Post. I mean, the fact that they put these egregious misuses of King, you know, on the front pages of their newspapers. I found even one thing that was really disturbing to me is that they are more likely to represent these right-wing misuses of memory than they are those by progressive groups that are actually calling them out, that are trying to correct the historical record. And so I think that says something about the media environment and the fact that it is so committed to profit, it is so committed to clicks and eyeballs on their pages, that they will uncritically represent these historical revisionist uses. And I actually think that's really part of the way that this has made it to the mainstream, rather than keeping the historical revisionism as a fringe kind of alt reality. It's become everyone's reality.
And you mentioned as well, there are these different, the most important gatekeeper, I guess, or the mnemonic gatekeeper is the members of the King family. And they are in a position to contest and challenge efforts to appropriate and exploit that history. And you mentioned that the example of the Glenn Beck rally, which I thought was fascinating, that it's the start of your book, where you've got these two different groups that are both on the Washington Mall. They're both laying claim to the same past, and they're both trying to tap into the King family for legitimacy.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, it's exactly right. So these are the mnemonic, the kind of memory gatekeepers, in the sense that they lend credibility to the memory. And in the book, I have this figure that thinks about kind of the folks that are inside guarding the collective memory. This is the original civil rights activist. This is the family members of King. And then, of course, on the outside, you have the folks that are really trying to remake and reuse. And at the bottom, you have the grassroots. So these are the folks that maybe weren't part of the civil rights movement, don't have a direct link to it, but are really trying to maintain the true radical memory. And so in that case in particular, I think what's hard to understand is just that the name alone, the King name alone, can lend credibility to misuses of memory. And we have Alveda King, who's Dr. King's niece, and she has been, you know, at the forefront of so many right-wing misuses of King's memory. And she gives them credibility because she has the King name. And at the same time, you have Coretta Scott King initially, you have the Martin Luther King Jr. You also have Bernice King, who is the executive director of the King Center. And she is now kind of the main person who's out here calling out the misuses of King. Although, as we see even in the conclusion of the book, it's not enough. I mean, you have folks that misuse King egregiously. She'll call them out and then they'll say, well, you should learn your history. And they say this to Dr. King's own daughter? And so it tells you something about the way that even those gatekeepers become defanged themselves. They become weakened in the public eye, and that the misuses of history are just incredibly deeply entrenched at this point.
So the civil rights era, it propels the struggle for a huge array of different groups that you mentioned for rights, for recognition, and they naturally look to the success of Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, as an example to follow. So they are tapping into this memory and this history to further their own cause. And much of your book are particular case studies of groups that are trying to do this, LGBTQ movement, the immigrant rights group, the Muslim activists. And in what ways are they trying to claim legitimacy by tying themselves to this particular past? How are they looking to adopt strategies or tactics from what they can learn from this past? And then how are they countered by different conservative movements?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the crux of the book is, you know, I make this argument that we need to look not only at the tools that social movements are using, but also at who's using them. So thinking about their relative level of power in society, the way that a group's identity is socially constructed, the way it's positioned in relationship to other groups. And so this kind of pairing of cases in each of these chapters is a way for me to get at the different ways that collective memory is used and misused, but then also to be able to say something about how power matters in the way that we remember and use history and use the past. So in this case, you know, I one of the things that I find is that when we look at these battles between these rival movements, we see that collective memory activates these kind of moral and national and racial boundaries. And so in that chapter that I'm thinking about these battles between the LGBTQ movement and the conservative family values movement, I'm really thinking about the moral boundaries of memory, this question of to whom memory belongs and who it can be used for. And so, you know, morality becomes one of these central grounds on which these movements are battling. And I think the reason the civil rights movement has become so central and taken up by so many different groups is precisely because it does make such strong moral claims. It tells such a strong story about who we are. And, you know, the minority rights revolution, as they call it, is this time during the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s when all sorts of groups, all kinds of groups, LGBTQ, immigrant rights, Chicano rights activists, disability rights groups, like they're all using the tools of the civil rights movement to vie for their rights because it is this framework for taking a historically oppressed groups and making claims to national inclusion, making claims to human dignity. And so it's unsurprising. I mean, this is something that's been so well documented. It's completely unsurprising that historically oppressed groups would use the tools of the civil rights movement. Now, on the other hand, I think it's when you see that it's not just them, that they're being rivaled by groups on the right who have historically been in power, who are the dominant groups in society, and they are also using the tools of the civil rights movement. And that increasingly, especially into the aughts, you know, into present day, they're claiming that they are the new victims. Now, that's really where it gets interesting. And so, you know, in that chapter on the LGBTQ movement, the family values movement, I'm really showing how these organizational leaders develop a strategy, especially on the right. They develop the strategy that represents Dr. King as a historical symbol of Christian morality, who would be opposed to gay rights. And, you know, there's this one quote where they print this flyer, and on the flyer they write, "Martin Luther King did not march or die for this. King would be outraged if he knew homosexualist extremists were abusing the civil rights movement to get special rights based on their sexual behavior." Now, I think that is such a good representation of the strategy that they continue to use, because it's not just that they counter the LGBTQ movement's claims that gay rights are civil rights. It's also that they then claim it for themselves, to claim that those special rights actually infringe on their own rights to religious freedom. And that strategy just becomes stronger and more powerful as time goes on. And so, you know, similarly, when I think about the immigrant rights movement and how they're countered by the nativist movement, I show how they're really trying to make claims that extend national identity. So the immigrant rights movement is saying immigrant rights are civil rights. And at the same time, these conservative groups are saying, oh, no, civil rights are for real Americans. And so they're kind of contracting the idea of who a real American is. And then over time, again, they're saying, oh, okay, well, if immigrant rights are civil rights, that actually infringes on our rights as real Americans. And so they become the victims again. So, you know, I think it's a really disturbing, but also valuable way to understand that when we talk present day about the politics of white grievance, it's rooted in something that goes way beyond the Obama era, right? It goes way back. And it's really rooted in this idea that multicultural democracy has infringed on other Americans' rights.
And I think what's interesting, too, that if you're looking at the left and you're trying to lay claim to this history, you're trying to adopt the tactics, the strategies that were successful for the civil rights movement, there are all kinds of factors that can complicate this. If your movement historically is tied into the civil rights era, then it's going to be a lot easier for you to lay claim to that past. If you're not, you almost have to go out of your way to create those ties. You mentioned the immigrants' rights group. They really have to study their history. They really have to kind of get their story straight, and they have to reach out to the civil rights leaders for their endorsement. So how does that work?
Yeah. And I thought this was kind of one of the most beautiful cases of a use of memory, because in so many cases, it's a co-optation. They're taking the memory, they're using it for themselves. And this includes some of the progressive groups. And in fact, they're taken to task for it. And many of these progressive groups over time come to understand, you know, that this was not the right way to go about things. But the immigrant rights group, they say that, you know, we would not have used the civil rights strategy if these Black civil rights leaders were not on board, if they had not given us their blessing. And so what they do, and this is specifically when we're thinking about the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, which unrolls in 2003. And this is a point where immigrant labor activists really want to make a claim that immigrant workers deserve civil rights, that they are being exploited, that there are all sorts of violent conditions. And so they're going to unroll a freedom ride where they take these buses across the country to raise awareness for immigrant rights as civil rights. And of course, they're hearkening to the original freedom riders, the civil rights activists. But they don't do this until they meet with Black leaders. And Black leaders sit with them. They talk for months and months and months. And finally, they get their blessing. They're on board. And it's not just a way to gain kind of public credibility as a performance to say, hey, look, we've got civil rights activists on our side. It's also a way to really understand that there's something meaningful about sitting with Black activists, about working together, developing these coalitions, and understanding that their fates are linked. It's not just that immigrant rights are civil rights. It's also that Black people are also immigrants. It's also that they're fighting for Black rights as well, and understanding that racism hasn't ended and that it's all embedded in a system that's pitting us against one another. So I think that's, you know, one of the challenges that they come up against. And of course, this is a way that right-wing groups also work to build these wedges, because they understand that without Black support, that these immigrant rights activists are, you know, they're going to be down on their luck. And so they work to build these wedges by approaching Black labor leaders and saying, hey, these immigrants are actually taking your jobs, and they're trying to claim that their rights are civil rights, but you all know about real civil rights. And so they try to kind of rile them up. They try to develop these wedges and try to kind of turn them against the immigrant rights activists. And occasionally it's successful, but, you know, most of the time it doesn't work because folks see through it. But so unfortunately, this is really where the right-wing activists then become kind of smart, and they innovate their strategies. And, you know, by the 2000s and into really present day, they have developed strategies rather that, you know, act like they are being victimized by immigrants. And so we've seen this kind of language of the immigrant threat, the immigrant criminality. You know, we think about like the Trump's words about the bad hombres coming across the border. This is really the language that develops a perception of threat, that they're coming after us, the real Americans. And so this is why immigrants cannot be granted rights. So it's understanding, too, that, you know, the strategy changes over time. Like, groups get smarter as they're in these battles with one another. They realize the old strategies aren't going to keep working. So they have to get smarter about how to use King and how to kind of put their hooks into history.
So there's this constant tug of war going back and forth where you're trying to find ways to claim legitimacy, to link yourself to that past. You're reaching out to these former civil rights leaders, and then you're reacting on the right, trying to undermine that legitimacy by reframing and recasting that group in terms of new threatening ideas that are so closely connected to immigration right now, about criminality and all the dangers that the border is supposed to represent.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So one of the problems you have as well, and I'm reading Isabel Wilkerson's book on caste right now, so it's really hard to not see this through that lens of caste. And you have all these groups who maybe were never really looked at as white, but benefited from that particular caste category. They were the middling groups, and they had a problematic relationship with the people who were, if you look at African Americans as the untouchables, as those people outside of the caste system, they didn't want anything to do with them. So when those groups try to struggle to promote their rights, they have this really problematic relationship with the civil rights area. It's not that easy for them to do this. And I think you use the Muslim rights activists as an example of this.
Yeah. So I really think about, you know, the Muslim rights activists, referring specifically to the Muslim immigrants that are South Asian, Middle Eastern mostly, you know, that are coming over after the 1965 Immigration Act. And this is a point where I ask this question, this puzzle, right? Because we've had this minority rights revolution where just about every minority group in the U.S. has used the memory and the tools of the civil rights movement to lay claims to inclusion and rights. And so the question that I pose then is, you know, when I'm looking at the evidence, why hasn't the Muslim rights movement done this? And when I dig deeper, I find that it took them almost three decades. And this is really, I refer to mostly like a post-2010 moment. It took them almost three decades to begin using the memory of the civil rights movement, in large part because they came to the States with the conception most immigrant groups do, which is that it is a system of white dominance. And so in order to be understood as fully human, in order to be understood as deserving of their full dignity, they have to position themselves as closely as possible to whiteness. And so that's really where I start to unpack that for them, the tools of the civil rights movement are the tools of a minority group. And they don't want to be understood as a minority group because to them, minority is, you know, sub. And so I think it's really tracing that and understanding this journey that a lot of these activists take from the early days of, you know, trying to quote unquote assimilate, thinking that, you know, if they have all the education, they drive the nice cars, they have the great paying careers, that they will be seen as fully American, they will be included and respected. And then moving into a post-9/11 moment where suddenly they're experiencing all of this backlash and violence. And I mean, truly some of their communities, folks are disappearing. They are just being taken. They're being deported. Nobody knows where they've gone. And then it's kind of this idea that like, okay, well, maybe if we just educate the public, they just don't know enough about Islam. Like maybe then, you know, we'll kind of be brought back into the good graces. And then moving into a moment where all of these reports are coming out in the 2010s about all of the undercover surveillance of everything from mosques to restaurants to student associations. And, you know, these Muslim rights activists are beginning to realize, you know, there is nothing we can do to be seen as fully human in this nation. And that's really when they come to understand themselves as a racialized group, as a group that is not unlike their Black and brown neighbors and colleagues. And that's really when they start to build the coalitions and start using the memories of the civil rights movement and saying, Muslim rights are civil rights, but also they're hooking into that history again. They're realizing, you know, the history of Muslims in the U.S. is a history of Black Muslims. It's a history of enslaved Muslims. And so then tapping into those deeper histories really brings them into greater solidarity in a meaningful way with Black Americans and understanding that they're not separate from them. They don't need to distance themselves from them. And that the system that's actually told them that they need to do that is what's at fault. Like that's what they need to be tackling, not trying to tackle, you know, folks need to be educated more, not trying to tackle, we need to educate ourselves more. It's understanding that this is a system that pits us against one another. And I think that's where you understand that collective memory can also be a bridge. It's not just a wedge that's drawn between people to push them apart. It's also something that can really bring people together.
And you mentioned that you have a similar problem within the Me Too movement, that you have this similar divide between white feminists and black women that has to be sorted out, that complicates the Me Too movement. What happens with that?
That's right. Yeah. This is a chapter where I'm really trying to think about this question of reconciliation. So I'm trying to think about, you know, if we have all these different cases that show us how the misuses of the past can be used to push us apart, divide us, is there any path forward for using memory as a way to come together? And this is where I look at the Me Too movement, which emerges, you know, in the wake of Black Lives Matter, in a time when the discussion about systemic racism has really moved to the forefront of society. It's no longer just on the fringes for the folks that are really down in the grassroots and doing the activism. This is a national conversation at this point. And so when Me Too emerges and folks immediately call out Alyssa Milano and they say, you know what, no, Me Too is actually attributable to this Black activist who coined this phrase, Tarana Burke. And then it becomes a deeper conversation for the feminist movement about their roots and about their histories of excluding Black women, about building a movement off their backs, but invisibilizing them, about all of the ways that anti-Blackness was kind of built into the white feminist movement and the multiple waves of it. And it's that reckoning. It's that work of really grappling with that messy and uncomfortable history, of doing the work of truth-telling, of centering the voices of Black women. And this is really a chance for many of the activists to think about how moving into a future where they work together really does require digging into that past. So it's not necessarily like a happy ending type of chapter. I mean, I really think about it as maybe some signals of progress, signals of where things could go, but then also as an open question, because, you know, I conclude that chapter with thinking about how a Black woman became CEO of the Me Too movement organization in 2020. And the question of whether that necessarily harkens to this quote unquote intersectional future that, you know, perhaps they're imagining.
You conclude kind of on a pessimistic note that if, on the one hand, if there's this been this exploitation of the civil rights past on the part of the right, There is a fact that framing of the past has been unquestionably accepted by a big, you know, swath of the American public, and there is to a certain extent a lack of understanding of history, and that if we're really going to question the uses of that past, you need to have an understanding of the reality of structural racism, of the inequalities that persist in society. And that involves this, a degree of honesty, a degree of racial reckoning that it seems like you're pretty pessimistic that that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because I'm a lifelong optimist. I'm an idealist. But for me, the pessimism is also a kind of hopeful realism, in the sense that I think once we realize that you can't just educate your way out of this, that some of the folks that are at the helm of some of these really strategic misuses of memory are some of the most educated folks, I think that's when you realize that the strategy isn't changing everyone's mind and suddenly having everyone have this like magical reckoning awakening. I think the power lies in the people. And so, you know, I will say, just to kind of build out some of that pessimism first, it's really that I think we have to realize the true reckoning is not going to happen, because we have already seen the way that the past has been used to erode multicultural democracy, everything from voting rights to civic participation, education, these ideas of who is even a legitimate citizen. And it's all built on this kind of evasion of social reality, you know, the thing that kind of stems from the culture of ignorance, which means that it's impossible to tackle these major social problems like racial inequality across social domains, like from education to policing. And it's also fragmented communities. I mean, we talk collectively all the time about political polarization as this huge issue, our inability to connect with our fellow Americans. But I think one of the big crises is really that this is a politics that's so committed to the status quo and really using memory to maintain the status quo, that it sucked all of the creativity out of our civic and our political life. It really has this stranglehold on our political imagination, where I think so many times we can't even imagine anything beyond the world of electoral politics. Like, this is the one place where we have to make change. So this comes back to where I really do see hope in the grassroots, in the people, because I think, despite the fact that we may not have much control over the way that memory is preserved on a national stage, institutionalized into social structures, we do have control over what we remember in our communities. And I think just remembering the memories of individuals and shared struggle is its own kind of historical artifact. It really becomes the stories of us as regular everyday people who can create change, everyday people as a source of power, a source of sustenance. And I think, understanding that this is who we are, our ancestors are carrying us, this act of remembrance individually and then also with other people in our communities can really become the lifeblood of a community. And so I think this helps root us in something beyond ourselves or even a lot of the doom and gloom of global and national politics, and then reminds us that we really can build the kind of worlds that we want from the ground up. So I think there is liberation just through the act of remembrance itself.
Haj, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Hajar Yazdiha is a professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. I've been talking with her about a recent book, The Struggle for the People's King, How Politics Transforms the Memory of the Civil Rights Movement. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, the best way to inform others is word of mouth. Tell a friend or family member, or send a link to a current or past episode. I'm Rick Tedarian. See you soon.